Hi, everyone. This is Holly Herndon.
I'm Matt Dryhurst.
And you're listening to
Interdependence.
If you're listening to this, you're listening to the free version. This podcast is completely ad-free and only possible through listener support. That sounds like a standard line, but it's true. It takes time and care to put this together, and without patrons, we won't be able to carve out the time to do this. So if you enjoy this podcast and would like to see it continue, please visit patreon.com/interdependence and subscribe, where you'll get access to our most recent conversations, as well as an archive of full-length past episodes. Thank you for listening. Bring, bring, bring. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you both for joining us. Would you mind, in sequence, I guess, maybe introducing yourselves for our listeners, please?
Sure. I'll go first. I'm Kayvon Turanian, the founder and CEO of Foundation. And have been in the crypto world for, I think, going on 5 years now, which seems like a long time, but also a short time.
And I'm Lindsay Howard. I'm the head of community at Foundation. And previously I was working as an independent curator specializing in digital art for the last 10 years.
Cool. So
it would probably make sense to maybe explain what Foundation is.
Yeah, exactly. Let's
who wants to take that one?
Let's do that. Who wants to take the first stab?
So I'll take a stab. But I also think the fun part about building something in crypto is that it can emerge and evolve. And so what Foundation is right now can dramatically grow. But at the moment, it is a tool, it is a network, it is a beautifully designed product that allows creators, artists to mint their work as a one-of-one NFT that then they are able to sell in an auction format on the blockchain using decentralized storage, using decentralized currency. And that is really the kind of the bedrock experience of Foundation.
And when did you start working on Foundation? When did it launch?
I started the company at the beginning of 2020. And we, for the entirety of 2020, we were running kind of one-off experiments with various people to kind of explore what was possible with creators and crypto was kind of the high level. Lindsay describes it as the cultural crypto space. And we really worked with folks. We worked with fashion designers. We worked with visual artists, painters, digital artists, musicians. And we're really just kind of understanding where they were coming from and what was most exciting to them about this space and this technology. And what we really learned, and, you know, it came from our kind of first NFT collection that we released in October, was that, you know, selling the ability to basically take a digital file, which was previously infinitely replicable, and monetize that in an entirely new way, was just the breakthrough use case. And so what we did is we went in heads down at the beginning of November. And so for November, December, January, our team just obsessed over and kind of just tried to perfect what we thought the best NFT experience would be and released that on February 3rd. And I believe most of your listeners will be familiar with us through that experience.
And Lindsay, how initially did you get involved with the project? I might say, and I might add that I think given the amount of you know, the amount of interest in this particular topic, that for me was how I first came to the project. Because Lindsay, you have been like a very prominent person within digital arts for a very long time, right? I think that, like, in a sense, your involvement with the project, at least from our perspective, was quite novel as someone, you know, we've been following this space for some time. But seeing that bridge take place with your involvement really kind of made a lot of sense. I wonder how you came to this.
Yeah, I had always been kind of put off by crypto. My first introduction to it was in 2012. I was working on a retrospective of the Free Art and Technology Lab, or FAT Lab's work. And they gave me a Bitcoin back then as a thank you. I think it was worth, I think it was worth about $50 back then. And I was like, thanks guys. But really thanks guys. And, but other than that, I felt kind of put off by crypto because the community didn't really, feel like something that was welcoming, and not really something that I wanted to be a part of. And then last year in kind of early 2020, was talking to some folks who were in the space, and they said, you know, there's about to be a kind of intersection of culture and crypto, and this is a space that you should really come in and start to explore because it's going to change things pretty radically. And so I jumped in. I had, you know, previously worked at auction houses. I organized the first digital art sales at Phillips. And then I got into micropayments and then crowdfunding. And, you know, alongside my interest in digital art as a medium, I've always been interested in how we can build a sustainable market. So to see what's happened over the last year and really in the last few months has just been incredible.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That also feels very, what's the word? That's kind of like a path that a lot of people have crossed, in the sense is that, you know, it appears to me at least that when people first encounter like the C word space, right? Like probably down to like to understandable naivety, people often encounter it as kind of like one monolithic thing. Whereas in actuality, and I think we'll probably talk about this a little bit more as pertains to like differences and approaches between different services, maybe in this kind of like nascent NFT space and other areas, you know, crypto culture is pretty wide, right? Like there's a pretty wide.
Well, I would say that it's widened. When I first got involved, I don't know, like 5 years ago, people were more on Slack back then rather than Discord. And I was usually like an anonymous male in like some of my channels because it felt pretty like female hostile, you know? So actually I think one thing that's been really cool to see about this NFT space kind of getting more popular is actually it has kind of widened, I think, who feels comfortable in this space.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is such a great like breath of fresh air. I mean, I've been working in it actively since, like kind of 2016 is when I entered, and this all resonates. And I think a lot of my frustration that led me to want to kind of break away from DeFi and really explore, you know, and I'll leave it as like creators cultural. I mean, I think it does stem from being that high level because like, you know, back in the early days of 2020, it was very just undeveloped. It's just really, really nice to see like new groups of people with very different perspectives, probably stemming a lot more into like visual and artistic and cultural sensibilities, kind of embrace this technology and reshape it and bring new perspective. Because for me, you know, by the end of 2019, the self-referential nature of crypto, where, you know, even Ethereum, which has all these possibilities, became like, you know, I'm going to create a token to create leverage, to get more Ethereum, to put into an interest rate protocol, to like get more leverage. Like I found it technically fascinating and I was very stimulated at that level. But then the insularity of the use cases and how self-referential they were felt really stimming. Like it was like, that's not what I wake up every day to build technology for. And now, you know, I'm in the opposite situation where we've unlocked these use cases for this much wider group of people. And it's just so invigorating. And that's just so wonderful to see. And I know that you both share this, which is like, this is, you know, this is what technology should do.
Yeah, it's tricky, right? Because kind of in parallel also to the observation that obviously for many uninitiated people, you know, initially they come in and they think, oh, okay, well, you know, crypto is one thing. And if you go on Twitter, for example, you'll find plenty to confirm to confirm that bias that crypto is basically just speculating on digital tokens, etc. Right. But I think there's also another point that's interesting here and maybe a tension, right? Which is that getting like translating to people, number one, that the real benefit of many of these decentralized tools is that ability for different communities to reshape things toward the purposes that will suit them, right? Is kind of like a new habit that's very difficult to convey to people, right? Because we're kind of used over the past decade to, you know, receiving kind of diktats from like one centralized service that decides, okay, this is what the future of media is going to look like it or lump it, like reorganize yourselves accordingly, right? Like Facebook has spoken or et cetera. And there's a tension there in a sense, because on the one hand, you have to start somewhere, right? And like many people, including yourselves, have started with this genesis point, which is kind of like, okay, right? Like we have the ability to verify the ownership and the kind of the non-fungibility of these titles to files, and that's a great starting point. But fundamentally, what the message that is difficult to convey is being like, okay, from that starting point, using these primitives, there's literally a thousand things that you could do, mm-hmm. right? Would you say that's fair? I mean, how thus far have you been able to navigate that the tension of communicating a narrative where on the one hand, you know, you're wanting to show people the possibility of these tools, and then on the other hand, you're wanting to convey to them, like, you know, this could be used in many, many different ways.
I mean, I think that's the number one reason why this job is amazing and interesting and challenging, is that that is just the crux of the matter, where the technology is so deeply capable and so deeply paradigm shifting, right? Where it's just flipping everything you kind of know about the internet and how it's built onto its head. But at the same time, it's you know, and I think this is what happens when, you know, only a certain cohort of people understand that that limits the possibility and actual potential of the technology, because that's such so many of those concepts are abstract. And mm-hmm. and so really what I think we've been able to do with the launch of our most recent product is just, it's made it so concrete and legible to just a very wide group of people that, you know, we can all appreciate what's happening under the hood, but I'm not sure, you know, we didn't lead with that. It doesn't beat you over the head with its kind of, you know, subversiveness at the contract layer or the protocol layer or, these other aspects of it. I think you have to let people go down that journey themselves and find it. And if you go too far away from where they're starting, they'll never get there. And so that's why I think things like design matters. The fact that it's so much more visual now, that it's much more social, that we're building identities, you know, and these identities are still malleable. They don't need to be real world identities, but they're at least some sort of like profile or, you know, anthropomorphic version of you, and not just these hex strings flying around or these wallets that are like, you know, really just transaction managers. You know, the technology is starting to feel more human.
That's one thing that I really appreciate about your, what are we calling it? Platform? Is that what you call it?
This is contentious, actually.
I agree. And I'm excited to use the word that meets people where they are right now, and we will evolve into the new words that people want to see as more people understand what's possible. Because
okay, I'm going to use platform.
I think platform is I think platform is great. I'm excited for that, because I am proud of the fact that you can show up to Foundation, and so long as you have a wallet and cryptocurrency, which is still asking a lot of people.
Yeah,
right.
It makes sense. Like, you can kind of like, we have tens of thousands of people using this and signing up for it and figuring it out. And that's not been true in crypto to date.
Yep. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so,
I've been using the term interface.
Yes.
I've been using the term interface as like as some kind of happy medium, but it's still not
protocol and even, platform.
Yeah. Yeah. Even that's like tricky.
Even that is so, you know, tech forward.
90s.
Yeah. But it's also like interfaces. Like, you know, when I think about the company, I'm like, yes, we're working on our interface layer, and we're working on our, you know, back-end indexing layer and our protocol layer. And all of these things are very technical, and they don't mean a lot to an enormous group of people, which is where you limit the potential of your technology if you really don't speak to a large group of people. Because like the fact that, and I'll just highlight this, like MIA right now is bidding on a piece from David Rudnick. And like that's the special sauce to me, not the fact that they use, like, of course I care that they used a wallet that they're in control of, that we have no access to, and they're interacting with trustless smart contracts that automate those interactions. But, you know, I don't want to lecture those people. I want to give them experiences that just make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And then the hope being that those interactions provoke the kind of curiosity necessary to think, oh, what else could you do with this, right?
Correct. And they're, and both of them are falling down the rabbit hole for sure. I mean, those are, those are two great minds that, that see the world in their own unique way. And now they have this new wild world to explore. And I think the thing that makes me so happy is so many people now are just telling us like the internet feels fun again.
Yep.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I was going to say one of the things I really enjoy about your platform is how you kind of contextualize a lot of the creators that are active on there with your editorial interviews. And
I would say that's a major distinction, actually.
Yeah.
In terms of like giving people like some kind of a bridge to be able to contextualize the work there. And also, most importantly, you know, in contrast to, let's say, some other services where – you know, the price seems to be leading everything. Mm-hmm. The attention, the curation, and the care in the way work is being contextualized really does make you stand out. And I mean, I guess
because it feels almost like a magazine. You can go through and you can learn about these different people, and then you can kind of see their work. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, that's what you know. I would love to hear from Lindsay on this front because that's uniquely what she's leading and curating. But that just matters because I think we all geek out on the technology, but the stories of what the people are doing with it is the point.
Yeah, all of the articles really focus on the numbers that are happening in the NFT space, which I get. They're very exciting, and we're definitely here for artists to make money. But it's also, there's so much more happening here. We're really in the midst of a very significant cultural moment. Where artists are coming in and learning about this technology, many of them for the first time, and seeing it through their eyes, I think is really crucial for technologists, for other artists, for other people who are beyond this space looking in for some kind of guidance. And so the way that we think about our editorial, which includes our blog and social, we do interviews and clubhouse rooms, and we're just very active in trying to help artists tell their story and really connect with collectors and each other on an emotional level. And I'm excited about the way that this is opening up opportunities for artists and creators to earn money in a new way. The rest of us have to buy our crypto, and the fact that artists are able to earn it and that these currencies have the potential to increase in value over time is really sparks a lot of ideas for me about what this could eventually lead to in terms of like a shift in power dynamics where artists are actually able to have more autonomy and are able to kind of direct their careers more. And the ripple effect that that would have on culture, I think, is incredible.
Yeah, I'd agree. I wanted to talk, actually, I didn't think about this before, but it's kind of an interesting topic to me. You know, I've been doing a lot of interviews. I don't know why, but like around about, you know, over the past month or two, obviously the topic specifically of NFTs and specifically of a particular application of NFTs has become quite big news, right? You know, one thing that I was attempting to do, at least in like speaking to a bunch of journalists on this, was attempting to present somewhat of a counter narrative to say, okay, well, you know, while it is true that, you know, at the moment you are seeing certain kind of images sell for significant amounts of money, a real disappointment is that somehow it's only that kind of anomalous price action that really captures the attention of, let's say, legacy media. And that in a way, like there's a real shame to that, right? Because maybe this will change, but legacy press, in only paying attention to, let's say, like kind of insane amounts spent on a Beeple, end up kind of presenting a self-fulfilling prophecy of the idea of this space just being kind of like a plaything for these kind of Veblen goods, right? These kind of like a plaything for very wealthy people to spend absurd amounts of money on something new and kind of miss the other story. And I wonder, one of my kind of reads on this in a sense is that that moment in a way appeared to have been coordinated largely, right? Like the sale of the Beeples, the sale, for example, closer to music of the Blau for, you know, $11 million or something along those lines, was coming from a very, very small group of people, like around kind of Nifty Gateway, around Origin Protocol. These things were being driven, in a sense, it appeared, by a small group of people to produce a media narrative. And one of the shames of that, or one of the challenges of that, is that when that media narrative came, it kind of almost like a snapshot took an image of the rest of the field, including yourselves, including a Zora or a, you know, Super Air or whatever. And this is the moment at which, like, you know, here comes everybody, right? All of a sudden, you've got people making jokes about Beeple on SNL. And now the state of where you were at the moment is, for better or worse, representative of your position in this field. First off, I think it would be interesting to just chat to you all about, like, what your experience has been navigating that, right? Because, like,
well, the timeline's fascinating. I mean, yeah, just hearing that you were building all through 2020 and then this kind of explodes. I mean, what must have that been like?
Yeah, exactly. Personally? Like, what was that like, and were you anticipating? Because obviously you were anticipating a moment and you're anticipating this stuff coming about, but it appears, at least from my perspective, that the media moment came a little bit unexpected, right? Like, people were being, the analogy I've been using is kind of like a photograph's being taken, and then some of the stuff I'm more interested in is like half dressed. You know, it's kind of like putting its clothes on while the wedding photographer is shooting the Beeple over in the corner. I just wonder how you all feel about that.
There was definitely a come to Jesus moment that we had last year, maybe early September or August. And it was actually in response to a collaboration that we did with Molly Soda, who has been an artist working in the net art space for a very long time. She came up through Tumblr maybe 10 years ago and has been extremely influential as a artist focusing on, like, kind of webcam performance works. And she did a release with us. And in conversation with her, that's when the kind of puzzle pieces started to come together, where we realized that there was an opportunity here where we could really jump in and support artists who had been creating and sharing their work online and been unable to monetize it. And that's when we started to, you know, we saw Matt Cain's sale, I think, was the kind of beginning of this, that triggered the interest in the kind of NFT as a potential market. His piece was the one that sold for over $100,000 in early September. I think all of those things kind of happening together, we realized on our team that we were really well positioned to respond to the moment, given how much we have this long-term relationships with artists, and also the abilities on the tech side as well to build out the product and design that would really be able to sustain and support them. I want to talk about Beeple, but I'll let Kayvon jump in on the come to Jesus.
Yeah, which is to say that, I mean, one, that we have not actively participated in this media narrative whatsoever. Any of our high profile auctions, the narratives, and we can go from Nyan Cat, where you have a viral meme that spread across the internet for over a decade without any ability to send, you know, like, compensation back to the original creator. Like, that's the story for us, right? It wasn't the price point. We're not out there pitching that. To some of the more recent auctions where, you know, the Iranian, the kind of the godfather of Iranian hip hop, who was kicked out of Iran, sold the album art to that original album. He was able to do that with cryptocurrency and kind of receive, you know, compensation for that kind of historic moment outside of the domains of, like, censorship, right? That matters to us. Let's go to now Snowden, which just took place yesterday, where you now have someone who I think so clearly represents why decentralization is going to be such a powerful force in this world for the next coming decade. These are the narratives that we're investing in as a team. These are the stories that we care about. Ultimately, we don't have control of the mainstream press. And I do hear you on this, Matt. But also, it's like, you know, we're not indexed on market cycles at the company. We're not trying to time market cycles. This company was started when Ethereum was around $70. It had nothing to do with the price of Ethereum. That is not how the business model came to be. The team, you know, Lindsay has a 10-year history in digital art. Most members of the team, including my co-founders, Matt Vernon and Alpizo, have been working. You know, Matt is one of the pioneering designers in the space. It's been irrespective of market cycle. You know, Alpizo has been building these crypto apps for many years as well. And so it's like, we're just not, the market cycles come and go, and you can ride them. The only people that really thrive in this ecosystem are the ones that are just focused on the fundamentals. And that's what we do. And, you know, Lindsay's right to call out, you know, our collaboration with Molly Soda in August, you know, really was for us the clarifying moment to go invest and develop our technology. And that was well before any of this press and these narratives formed.
Absolutely.
And the one last thing I'll just share is that when you think about the product and what it unlocks, it fundamentally is a net new introduction to the internet of a behavior.
Yep.
You could not previously, before inventing this, take a file and represent it scarcely. And so irrespective of the market cycle, that behavior is going to exist on the internet, and we are going to support it. And that the market going up and down is not something that will change our behavior.
Lindsay, I want to let you jump back to your previous thought.
When I organized the first digital art sales at Phillips Auction House in 2013 and 2014, I really got to go into the belly of the beast, as you could say, to see how auction houses really build markets. And that was something I was really fascinated by and continue to be fascinated by, especially when it comes to digital art, whether that's kind of art websites or online performances, generative work. It's a pretty expansive medium under that umbrella. And what I came to see is that auction houses are really about providing a PR muscle, basically. Yep. And what we were able to accomplish with those digital art auctions in 2013 was we opened up a collector base, or broadened a collector base, for digital art and for the galleries that are representing digital artists. And we were also able to have tremendous press kind of helping us tell the story of how you collect digital art, which at the time was a USB drive. Mm-hmm. And so when I saw the Beeple auction come up, PAX auction come up, I really understood them as kind of levers in an ecosystem that can be helping us open this space up more broadly, bring people in, whether they are skeptics or speculators or art lovers or whomever they may be, and whatever kind of energy it is that they're bringing in. It opens up the space so that more people can come in, ask questions, and start to understand this. People who do come in with that critique right off the bat, I'm totally fine with those people. I think that those questions and that criticality is actually really important. And that's actually that's something that artists do so well, which is why I'm so glad that they're here. And I think we're seeing that in a lot of different ways, how artists are challenging the kind of crypto space and these systems and really having a voice here. So absolutely, I think the auctions are performative, just the way that they are designed to kind of trigger adrenaline rush in these. I mean, that's just what they are, and they aren't the whole answer, but I think that they are something that helped give this space a boost. And I think that that's actually a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, if yesterday's Snowden auction is anything to go by, I was actually saying on Twitter that you could sell tickets to it. We'll get to that, but I agree. I mean, I think that's very sober in so much as that, you know, you can't control the media narrative. You certainly can't control, you know, a few actors kind of, pulling those levers as you describe them. But what you can do is you can establish credibility, which I think you all have done very well, right? Which is establish credibility by, you know, speaking to artists who have a long-term commitment to digital art. And in many cases, this is the first time that they're seeing real kind of compensation for all the great work that they've been doing that was somehow like the blind spot of the traditional art market, which, you know better than I do, Lindsay.
Why I think the Molly Soda example mm-hmm. seems like it was this big turning point
Andrew
for
Benson,
them.
Andrew Benson,
because I mean, they've just been so generous with their work online for so many years. It's really nice to see people see some of that come back.
Absolutely. And also that focus on historical work. Yeah.
And the previous mechanisms are like views, likes, follows,
right?
And these are the mechanisms that the internet had to give to these people. And they're valuable to some extent, for sure. Don't get me wrong. But that's why I think the NFT is so, it's not something we're going to undo. We're not going to like just abandon it. It's irrespective of the market cycle. These people, I think, inherently value an NFT because there's no way for their work, which really exists as a file, to otherwise be able to hold value. And that's just a breakthrough. And I think it's unfortunately just too high of an expectation to expect the mass media to be able to understand the nuance of that quite yet. And the only thing I can tell you that's encouraging is we're not going anywhere. We're going to be around. And I think you will see the narrative eventually arrive at where it should be, but it will probably take years. We're patient and our team is not, it's not riding this hype cycle to survive. It was already here in a lot of ways.
Of course, it's a little bit cringe sometimes to hear a specialist at Christie's or something goof and say something wrong or not quite understand the tech, but that's part of the process. And I think even some of the critiques about the aesthetics and in crypto art have been a little bit misguided as well, because I think what we do need to acknowledge is that there have been people who have been working in this space for a while. They've kind of laid the groundwork for it. But we also need to be good stewards and help people who are coming into this space for the first time kind of connect with different collectives or scenes or other artists or technologists so that they can kind of come to define their own way of thinking about this space. And we're not all starting from one point. We're all at different points in our understanding and way of thinking about it. And I think that just needs to be respected.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. And again, this goes back to the snapshot analogy I tried to mention earlier. It's like people are coming in, and I don't think that many people are aware just how early we are. And in a sense, just how kind of miraculous it is that, services such as your own and others in the space are quite as developed and ready to do, to do the work you're doing at this particular point, right? This is a very, very nascent field. And so, I was reading an article in like the New York Times a couple of days ago, speaking about like goofs, where like, you have like a staff writer talking about how, Bitcoin is eventually planning to move to proof of stake. And you're like, wow, okay, like this, maybe for some listeners that doesn't sound as preposterous as it does, but it's like, that is like one of the most fundamental misconceptions anybody could have, right? And the fact that that can get through, fact checkers in like a very, very handsomely funded institution just kind of tells you how early this narrative is. And so in a sense, it's almost like I think some of the critique exactly around aesthetics or, kind of maybe sometimes like asymmetry of price action around certain works of art versus other more interesting stuff. It's like my take on this is that it's just kind of a miracle this stuff is happening out in the open, and none of those critiques in any way kind of preclude these primitives and these services being used for kind of whatever you want, right? Like,
but also we don't need to carry over the kind of hierarchical way of thinking from the previous ways of doing things. And this new space that we're creating, if we want it to be more open, if we want it to be more inclusive and diverse, then we need to be aware that there are going to be a lot of different perspectives here on the tech. There's going to be different perspectives on how it's implemented, on how community is structured, on what community means. And I think like being able to facilitate that kind of dialogue is going to be the kind of make or break for this, because you're right, we're not there yet. This is all very early and very much a work in progress, but we need to be open to varying levels of understanding and really be open to seeing what's possible and what a lot of different voices can contribute to the conversation.
For sure. So while a lot of the kind of insane price points have been, you know, used in the press for kind of like, you know, clickbait, whatnot, it still is something that can kind of drive excitement. Like you said, Lindsay, it can be kind of almost like a performance, the auction itself. And I noticed that you all also use an auction format, and we were watching the Snowden auction last night and it was really exciting.
Yeah.
So there is this kind of, I don't know, tapping into something that does have to do with markets and does have to do with, you know, a competition of some sort that's not necessarily a bad thing. So how do you balance that, when you're approaching these kind of astronomical figures at times?
I don't see it as a competition. I don't see it as a kind of scarcity. I think that there is space here for many different types of creators to succeed.
A second. When I said competition, I was actually referring to the bidders.
Oh, okay.
Because it felt, and it just felt like there was that kind of, almost that narrative.
It was happened. Like a tournament.
Yeah. I mean,
it's thrilling. It's thrilling. Yeah,
part of the excitement it felt like they were all competing with each other to win the prize. Maybe competition's not the right word, but they're, you know, they were trying to outbid each other. And that was one of the things that was actually really thrilling about the process.
Yeah. The fun part about it is just think about what that competition is facilitating. Because, you know, I commented on this and there was an artist, I think, that joined us pretty early on and had the experience of just like wanting to buy a bunch of pieces and being outbid every time and just kind of being befuddled because it's like, am I supposed to be upset because I'm losing yet the artists are winning? So it's like, you know, this mechanic is ultimately serving the creator. And then in the case of Snowden, it's like, let's go even levels deeper. It's like, you know, we have the narrative of a community of people bidding against a single individual, right? And that dynamic playing out. And then the community actually winning because they were just able to rally so many different people to the cause that an individual did tap out, right? Against that. And then you also have
asleep.
I given all the adrenaline, we were experiencing just watching it, I really struggle to believe that you would fall asleep.
Terrified if someone
falls asleep bidding millions.
Millions, and I'm like, I'm terrified of that. we should qualify that though, because I think first off, like maybe we should start off because we're coming at this knowing number one what the function of the Snowden auction was, and number two what the PlazerDAO is. Maybe we can just give a bit of a prehistory on what this is before we get into like the excitement of it.
so as in describe what happened. And then we dissect it. Okay, so Edward Snowden released his first NFT with us, minted it this week, and then put it up for auction on Thursday. And it was, in honor or, you know, the proceeds were intended to be, for the Freedom of the Press Foundation, which is something he's actively involved in. And then the artwork is a combination of an incredible photograph and is superimposed on the court ruling that ruled that the NSA's mass surveillance did violate the law. So I think just a very evocative piece of art that both has political, social, and kind of cultural relevance. And then we had a very high profile auction, in which case, a DAO, which is a group of people pooling resources together on the blockchain, essentially was in a bidding war with another individual for the piece. And eventually it reached a price point, over $5 million during the course of the auction. Is that a good synopsis?
I think we should also say that it's the fourth highest selling NFT and the first three are Beeple.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Cool.
Yeah. Congrats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to a really good cause.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to a really, really.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, I mean, and it's, you know, I think that the amount of money that, this, you know, organization received essentially is, I don't know the exact figure, but I believe it's on the order of like quadrupling their annual budget in an hour.
Yep.
Wow. Yep. Wow.
Yeah, it's wild. A few points on that. Number one, I mean, following the online discourse around this stuff is oftentimes just as thrilling as following the auction itself. I noticed there was arguments breaking out today where people are like, oh, well, you know, the Freedom of Press Foundation should hold on to that ether because it's going to be worth so much more. And then people are like, no, the whole point of this is that they get to cash out now and do good now, you know, like, so seeing people debate around such a generous kind of contribution is wonderful. But I wonder too, Lindsay, would you mind giving a bit of context specifically around PleaserDAO and the genesis of that? Because this is something that like we personally are very, very excited about, and I think subtly represents a shift that is occurring, that going back to some of, you know, the stuff we were talking about earlier of like, okay, people are slowly coming into this space. They're figuring out what a wallet is, right? They're figuring out that now you can start bidding and transferring value over to these people creating artworks. And then subtly somewhere in the distance, like this kind of DAO wave is happening. And it, in my mind, it represents a major shift in the way in which these things have run before. Would you mind giving us a bit of context on, you know, let's say the genesis of PleaserDAO and what transpired yesterday?
Yeah, it's been really wonderful working with Freedom of the Press Foundation in preparation for this auction. And they had actually told us that they have been accepting cryptocurrency as donations for the last 3 or 4 years. So this is not entirely new for them. I'm not sure whether they're going to keep it in crypto or cash it out into USD, but this is definitely something that is close to their mission and the kind of work that they do to support investigative journalists and also really courageous whistleblowers like Snowden himself.
Yep.
For the auction that took place on Foundation, I want to talk about the kind of high bidders who are duking it out in the end. But first, I want to mention the early bids that were on this piece. And one of the things that's so exciting about these auctions is that all of the bids are permanently on the ledger. So there are people who knew they were not going to win the piece ultimately, but they wanted to show up and just make sure that their name was there as having contributed to this really important cause that they care a lot about. And
that's an interesting point.
Yeah,
exactly. And one of the collectors I want to call out is, his name is Mondo on Foundation, Amir in real life. And he was one of the early bidders. He was pushing the price up and he was posting on Twitter about how he just wanted to rally people around this work because it was so important. What Freedom of the Press Foundation does and what they represent for freedom of speech and journalists who have been suppressed and killed all over the world, trying to tell stories and hold governments and people in powerful positions accountable. He was not approaching this as, you know, stand back, I'm going to win this NFT. He was really approaching this as, please, someone else bid against me because we need to raise as much money as possible for this really important cause. And so I do want to make sure that Amir is mentioned here, even though he wasn't the final bidder or one of the last couple of bidders. That kind of spirit is something that I think is very unique to the crypto space and NFT space. And ultimately, the auction really started to take off and we saw some spectacularly generous numbers, both from PleaserDAO and a collector named AAA. And they were bidding against each other for a couple of hours, which were very entertaining hours for all of us to watch. And you know, with crypto, everything is public. So you can see the wallets. You can, you know, on Twitter, the kind of members who are participating in PleaserDAO were really coming together there. The history of PleaserDAO, as I understand it, is that they were formed a few weeks ago. So a pretty new collective. around this piece by People Pleaser, who's a digital mm-hmm. artist who created a video to promote Uniswap's V3 launch. And a member of the crypto community tweeted out, "Hey, does anyone want to form a DAO to buy this piece?" And started a Twitter thread where people were like, "Yeah, I do." And what was really cool at that time was to see that even when there were other individual bidders who were coming in to place bids on People Pleaser's piece, they would tweet at that person and say, "Hey, join our DAO and let's let's let the people own this piece together." So this was the first time that Pleaser DAO came back. They tweeted out some fighting words at the beginning of the day before the auction Snowden really took off, letting people know that they were going to win this. And I think more members started joining Pleaser DAO over the course of the day because they really wanted this to be owned by the people. They wanted it to be owned by a collective, and ultimately they did win. And it sold to the piece sold to Pleaser DAO for 2,224 ETH, which is around $5.4 or $5.5 million.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, it was also thrilling to watch in the middle the Pleaser DAO, you know, tweeting at AAA or Xakes2K on Twitter. Like, what, you know, why are we fighting together? Like, just join the DAO.
Exactly.
Which I thought, I mean, beyond the precedence, I think, which is such a significant break, I think, from the way in which this kind of collection of, you know, individuals collecting individuals has been framed largely. But yeah, I was there tweeting at Zakes or AAA too, being like, please join the DAO. This will accelerate the conversation. In a way, I would be so excited about. Like, history compels you to join this DAO. That would be such a beautiful. Moment. But it appears that he claims, at least for those who weren't following. He claims at least that he lost the auction because he fell asleep at his keyboard.
Well, maybe he will still join the DAO.
He'll still join the DAO. That sounds.
I mean, he did make another offer on the piece on the secondary market. So there's some interesting story unfolding here. But I think that's also the beauty of NFTs, which is these auctions are really just, you know, they're very important moments. But these NFTs have lives now. They're alive. They now live on the blockchain. And this NFT in particular is fascinating because it went for such a high price point, you know, and it now is in the hands of a DAO. And then I also will, and I think this is something that's a story we'll have to tell over the many coming months, but like, you know, we're really, Foundation's designed as a DAO as well. And so I was hoping you were going to
bring that up. You know,
and so, you know, there's been, you know, lots of raging, you know, kind of, threads and topics on, you know, is this community owned? Is it community governed? What does that mean? And then I think we're just really going to barrel into this future by really demonstrating it in reality, which is People Pleaser is now a force that people cannot deny. They were able to win two very competitive auctions. One, as Lindsay mentioned, for the Uniswap V3.
Pleaser DAO, right?
Pleaser DAO, yeah.
You know, was able to win the auction for Uniswap V3's NFT, and now the Edward Snowden NFT, and then it's in the hands of the DAO. And you know, these people, I know many of them in it for a long time actually, and they're very sophisticated actors, and they're going to lead. They're going to demonstrate what is possible to a lot of. And this, Matt, I think speaks to all the things that you're excited about, which is they're going to show that the NFT auction is just the entrance into the space. It's not the destination. And it's going to be very fascinating to see one, how Snowden's now a part of the Foundation DAO in a very significant way. And as is Pleaser DAO, and then the NFT from Snowden is in the Pleaser DAO's, you know, contract. And these are all forces that are unfolding. And it's going to be a very fascinating story to watch unfold. And that'll take place over years. And so I think where I'm at is like, let's not be impatient, but it's here and it's happening, and we couldn't be more excited about that future. We are aligned, Matt, in wanting and focusing on these new realities, not on the single price point auction marks.
100%. I was hanging out in the foundation Discord after and during the Snowden auction. And it was really cool to see artists who are just entering into this space asking, like, what is a DAO? And then having that epiphany moment of saying, like, wait, we should form a DAO actually, so we can buy each other's work and so that we can, you know, create together and support each other and build out this market. And I think that was a really empowering moment that and a learning moment for the whole community more broadly.
Totally. And I mean, I think this is great timing actually, because this is kind of inaugurating what's going to be a month to 6 weeks
of
heavy DAO focus in our lives, let's just say. For those who are completely unfamiliar with what we might be talking about, I'm hoping that our enthusiasm about the term has kept them listening thus far. Would one of you mind explaining to the best of your abilities what a DAO is?
Well, that is not a simple question, Matt. I will challenge your audience, which is I will try to go at the highest level to explain what a DAO is, but then to realize that it's a very fractal concept. So I will argue, and this is something that I do believe, and it's always been my framework, which is Bitcoin is the original DAO, because a DAO is simply a way to align incentives amongst a group of people, right? And so Bitcoin did that by saying there are miners, there are token holders, there are all these members of this kind of online emergent entity, right? And they, by holding a Bitcoin or a piece of Bitcoin, essentially become part of a DAO because they're all aligned in creating value for Bitcoin. And so I think that's the genesis of it. And that's how I think about it, because there is no boss of Bitcoin. There is no central governing body that was, anointed. It's this kind of decentralized, autonomous organization, right? And then you have Ethereum come along, and what it does is it adds programmability to that, so you can be more expressive about what these DAOs are. And of course, what's the first thing that gets built on Ethereum? It's a DAO, right? It's a programmed DAO. Of course, we all know where that goes, which is, that was very early days, and the programmers
we'll cover that.
The programmers were not yet aware of all the what happens when you upload code to a shared machine and the vulnerabilities that stem from that. So we all know where that goes, but I think we'll all remember that as really a historical moment, because I think Ethereum's killer application is the ability for us to form DAOs, to form online organizations that can essentially live and govern themselves through the internet and need nothing but the internet. They can manage internet assets, they can manage internet money, they can they can manage all sorts of things. And it's all done through the internet natively without any need to go, to a governing body, to the rule of law. And so what does that mean? That means someone in Japan can work with somebody in Australia, can work with somebody in Berlin, and they can all speak kind of the same language. And that language can be financial, which is just not possible in our old world.
Yeah, we couldn't honestly be more excited about it. It's funny that it's actually really, really, I mean, it's really cool, if not a little contentious to frame Bitcoin as the first DAO, but I actually kind of agree with your formulation of that idea, and would also want to shout out the other internet people for the headless brand concept, or the headless kind of organization concept that I think is very
complimentary
to your reading on that. Yeah. I mean, for us, we've been like, DAOs were the first thing that got us quite excited about this space.
Made a track actually in 2014 that we released in 2015 on our album platform called DAO.
Yeah, it's funny. We actually have a piece of artwork out there about DAOs before the first quote unquote DAO was built. But of course, nobody at the time had any context for it.
It was about a kind of decentralized voice. And when I performed it live at the Guggenheim, my soprano was based in Oklahoma. And she was singing through the internet, but I had her body physically in the space. It was weird.
Yeah, it was very strange. But all this to say that this is like, for us, because beyond the particularities of how far this stuff has needed to come to get to this point, that something like a Pleaser DAO can come together in an afternoon, albeit with a bunch of people in the space who kind of know what they're doing. But the fact that it's come to this point now, for us, I completely agree with you. That is the kind of the killer application, the kind of like what's new about it, right? Beyond the particularities of the primitives and what you can, how you can combine them. The idea of creating these organizations with people all across the world, aligned under certain missions, to us is just like, that's been the reason to be involved in the space, to be quite honest. It's really exciting to see them manifest, and start to kind of like crest into public awareness, you know, because obviously there's been a number of DAOs in the space for a few years.
I think as we go even further, which is, the first thing that was really built on Ethereum was a DAO, right? So this is like, and I think for any hardcore nerd who has been, you know, who's been enamored with this technology and its potential, the DAO and DAOs are just it's the catnip. It's just such an unbelievable breakthrough. But, you know, the interesting thing that I'll throw out there that I think is happening now is we've had the technology for quite a while. The thing that's interesting now is the fact that you have enough people fluent in the core technology. The currency actually has enough value to sustain interesting economies. And then third thing is you have people like Snowden or all of these other artists creating these artifacts that are now digitally represented that can then be held by these DAOs. And so that's why I think we're in this really interesting moment where we've known that this is the vision that's interesting, but it takes the confluence of like a general fluency, a interesting enough kind of artifacts being created on the blockchain and the currency being valued by enough people for it to all kind of really sing. And that's all starting to happen right now.
Yeah, it's wild. It's a dizzying pace, right? I mean, we're looking forward to inviting Aaron and Priyanka from OpenLaw, the Lab, Flamingo DAO, etc., in a couple of weeks. Also on the work that's been doing to formalize these DAOs in kind of, you know, quote unquote IRL, right? With what's happening in Wyoming at the moment, which we won't go into too much, but the pace is dizzying. It's very exciting.
I'm curious to hear what does, you know, foundation as a DAO, what does that mean functionally?
Yeah. I mean that I'm so glad that came up because I wasn't sure, you know, I've seen some small comments online talking about it, but I think that's a wonderful thing to discuss in this context.
Well, so there's some precedent, right? I think we can look to some of the DeFi protocols and understand what they've been able to do, which is, I think from the most important way I think about it is like a DAO can be anything. It can start from two people and it can scale up to, I think, the entire Bitcoin network, right? And I think that's an incredibly wide range of what a DAO can be, which is why I think it's very hard for people to grok or truly understand DAOs, because it's a very wide concept, like two people collaborating with a set of rules, you know, in a smart contract is a DAO, in my opinion. But then you take Uniswap, which has, you know, I think one of the largest user bases on Ethereum, and it's a DAO, right? Because, you know, people that use that product, people that really made it a center of gravity on the Ethereum blockchain, were compensated through an ownership stake in the actual underlying protocol. That's profound. And so, you know, we just had this Coinbase IPO, which I think is so illustrative of how the world did work. And, you know, Coinbase came out in a way where when DAOs were too fledgling for them, I think, to really embrace that future. But we're now moving to a world where, you know, I think it's pretty strange, especially if it's a crypto native application, for you to ever think about that trajectory of like, we're going to raise successive rounds of venture capital, and then we're going to, you know, engage in a set of investment bankers based out of New York City to then bring this like corporate entity onto a publicly listed stock exchange. Like all those words I just said are being replaced with internet native versions of whatever those were. And those internet native versions are massively more democratized, massively more scalable, global on day one. And so, you know, when I say foundation's a DAO, I mean, again, I think we're really as a culture going to need to just figure out how to like develop language to describe this. But at the end of the day, I think the most important concept is that it's not, we're going to exit to the community, right? We're not going to exit to the stock exchange. I think that's really powerful. I mean, I don't think anyone is enamored with the IPO process. It's like all the value that got generated by the product, by the community, doesn't have an opportunity to really access any of that or participate in any of that until it reaches this, like, you know, very late stage. And then there's all these people in New York that don't really have, I don't think, like, a special sauce, you know, outside of it really being a legacy, institutionalized, you know, regulated thing. And we now have invented things like Uniswap and tokens and Ethereum. And I think it just unlocks a new reality. And I think it's as simple as saying Uber and Airbnb are great examples of those products are useless without their users and their community providing value. And they're locked out of the actual structure that holds the value.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I was joking with someone recently about, you know, Spotify being maybe like an analogous to that in the music conversation. And I'm like, it just feels like an inevitability. Now that cat is out of the bag, like, those organizations will die by 1,000 equity cuts. You know, it's like, once you're aware or familiar with those mechanisms of exiting to community, of like equity stakeholdership or whatever, like, there's nothing to put that back in the box. There is nothing to put that back in the box. That if there is a service that you're able to use and contribute to, where you feel like you're part of this collective and you can benefit from the joint work that you're doing together, it's dangerous and incredibly encouraging. And I wonder, Lindsay, like, you know, I'll try and contextualize this a little bit, but I wonder, like, what some of these ideas in your perception mean coming from like an art historical context, and also the more recent kind of context of digital art, in the sense that, you know, I'll never forget, like, a couple of years ago, we collaborated with a good friend of ours who's like a very prominent person, you know, in the capital A art world, right? Like, someone who sells work for decent amounts of money, is on the art power list or whatever. And we were having a conversation with him about a collaborative piece we did together. And it was such an interesting conversation, because he was like, yeah, you know, like, this is awesome. Like, let's figure out, you know, how to structure this, right? Like, and ultimately the one thing that stuck with me is he was like, you know, at the end of the day, if we were to do this as like a collaborative piece together, he's like, what you have to understand is it won't sell.
Or it won't sell for as much.
Yeah. He's like, it might sell, but he's like, but basically, one important thing to understand about the way in which the world I operate is working is that the second that you have kind of a collective in place, you know, it's considered maybe cool. It's considered like a really interesting thing to exhibit, but fundamentally, you know, like, the collector base isn't there for the collective in quite the same way. And I wonder what some of these conversations around DAOs, for me personally, I'm quite excited at what that means. That means in this art historical context, like as another potential opportunity to maybe fork away from, you know, old bad habits.
Well, also maybe framed in a different way. Sorry, Lindsay, we're like throwing a lot at you right now. But I remember we were having a conversation a month ago or something, and we were talking about institutions, and you were talking about how kind of frustrated you were with traditional art institutions, and how that's why you were so excited about this kind of crypto space. And one thing that I kind of see in DAOs is this ability almost to build new institutions, 100%. even if we maybe see institution as a dirty word. So how might we, what are some ideas for these kind of new institutions that are able to avoid some of the pitfalls of the past?
NetArt started as a response to feeling like there wasn't a way to gain access or a point of entry into traditional institutions. So a lot of artists who could have gone on to be major names in major museums went and found their audience online instead. And I can speak to my own experience in the early era of the post-internet movement. What we were doing is that I had a friend who had a warehouse in Brooklyn, and I had friendships online with artists like John Raffman and Brad Trammell, Parker Ito, Petra Courtright, and we were all just hanging out on the internet. And we thought, wait, what if we take our net art pieces and bring them into this like physical warehouse space, photograph them, Photoshop them, put them back online and make them look like we have this kind of institutional stamp of approval. And we started playing with that, messing with that kind of model until many of those artists actually went on to gain gallery representation and be make a career out of being an artist in the traditional art world. And that didn't come from someone plucking them out of obscurity. That came from us playfully collaborating and kind of operating and facilitating this almost like hall of mirrors where we were taking pieces, putting them into this like junky warehouse and then spinning them out as if they were like beautiful works of art until they did become beautiful works of art. And until we did become curators and artists and collectors ourselves. So I think that this model of a DAO has precedent. There have been artist scenes and artist collectives for as long as there have been artists. It's just that now there's an actual kind of technical mechanism to accomplish it in a way that is not just about kind of loosely rising up as a crew. And, you know, some people gain more than others. It's really about like kind of opening up space for kind of group voting and like shared wealth or squad wealth. So I think it's more of an evolution of things that are naturally already occurring. And I think that this idea of collectivism and wanting to evolve like with your direct community is something that is really needed in this moment. And I think it will evolve to show us new types of art. It will evolve to show us new types of collectors. It already is showing us that kind of signal. And we're just going to see even more how this kind of has a ripple effect on the way that we value work, the way we write about work, and the way we historicize artwork.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, that's probably a bit of a detour, but there's analogies in music too, right? Where it's like the idea of the lone genius has been like kind of the driving force behind most historicization of music. And of course the truth of the matter is that most things came out of communities, right? And that in fact, actually, I mean, we're speaking on a podcast called Interdependence for a reason, but the truth is that actually the interdependence of scenes is what allowed for individuals to flourish oftentimes. I mean, I always love to bring up the example when I first started talking about crypto to music people, I would bring up the Art Ensemble of Chicago, which is a reference that is rather niche, but it's an example of a group of very, very groundbreaking kind of jazz improvisers, experimental improvisers, who as a model established a group in which, you know, they would perform works, but everybody learned everybody else's repertoire. And they kind of pushed this model as a collective. And the strength of that group gave everybody the ability to basically recede into the background and give precedence to an individual at different points in time. And those improvisation dynamics really came to categorize the group, but it's,
that's kind of the law of improvisation in music, because if everybody wants to solo at the same time, it sounds like shit. So you really have to be sensitive to that.
Totally. And that's the thing, but you have these precedents, but ultimately, you know, the formal mechanisms by which this stuff was valued out in public ended up again, like, you know, glomming onto like one of the individuals who happened to be particularly virtuosic in what they did, while ignoring those group dynamics. And the great hope here is that, you know, the DAO, as you explained, Kayvon, I think is like, it's a fundamental idea to this space, you know? And so once that stuff gets spread out, I can only imagine once that stuff proliferates more and people start playing with it more, I can only imagine that this space will value that kind of collective creation of new different types of artworks and as something native. You know?
And it's also a kind of salve for some of the alienation that I feel like people are really expressing and feeling right now, not just through the pandemic, but just through kind of contemporary life.
Mm-hmm.
I think alongside all of this, we also need to be aware of the kind of responsibility of what it means to be forming groups and the kind of psychologies of group dynamics. And I've been thinking about that a lot in terms of community at Foundation and how we think about kind of community guidelines and structures and creating space for a lot of different people to contribute and make sure that their voice is heard. Because I think that these models, as much as they have precedent, are not, they're not solved yet. These are things that we still need to create. And so one thing that I've been thinking about is like, what does trust and safety look like in Web3? And how do you think about kind of community health in a model where there aren't hierarchical kind of policing structures, but more kind of ensuring that there's accountability and responsibility within a larger group space.
For sure. And what is important for kind of like trust and health in one DAO might be very different, might look very different in another DAO.
Yep.
Those are the conversations that I want to be having with people right now is as we evolve into this next era, it's not just about walking into a utopia. It's also about like this, these are new kind of spaces that we're entering in, and we need to be very communicative and generative with the way that we think about it and can really consider it a work in progress so that we are shaping this together.
And Kayvon, you wanted to jump in at some point.
No, other than to say that, you know, Matt, it's, we're very aligned in our interests in terms of where we want the space to go. And I think that the interesting thing is just to be in constant dialogue around this because, you know, Foundation is a DAO. It's designed as a DAO. But then it's also now fractally composed of other DAOs. So, you know, our job is, you know, and this is something we take very seriously in our responsibility. But we're also aware that this will take years. So we're not impatient in figuring it out. But it's like, yeah, I mean, I don't see a world in which we're not on the internet, in which NFTs are a first-class citizen in every experience you have on the internet. And DAOs are not something that you're just, you know, you're in some sort of enormous overlapping Venn diagram of the variety of DAOs that you're in. I think humans are inherently social. And I think that these lone bidders, you know, will soon really give way to collectives saying, this is the culture we want to, you know, support. This is, you know, and just even the experience of being part of a group, no matter how big or small the group is, will just mean a lot more than being on your own. And I think that it's just going to be a very fascinating couple of years. And I'll emphasize years here. I think that the people in crypto that don't stick around and don't see things through and kind of get frustrated miss out on these moments because you don't know when they're going to happen. I just know that they're inevitable, and we're just designed to really kind of ensure that we're there and can help create this kind of new reality.
Yeah, that's really sober. I mean, and I also think your point on this, Lindsay, was sober too, right? It's like, this is not, I mean, it's one of the things I've had a hard time communicating to people, which is, it's kind of analogous to the challenge of like reading Web3 like Web2, right? Like reading protocols and interfaces and these words that maybe some people are just coming to, like centralized platforms. There's a similar, in a way, like, you know, in embracing decentralization, there is kind of a Faustian bargain there, right? Where the Faustian bargain is that when you don't have a central actor dictating how things go, on the one hand, there are all these wonderful kind of fractal organizations that could spawn from that. And on the other hand, it's also very sober to accept that you're also going to see a lot of really bad stuff. You know, that's kind of like comes with the territory in a sense. But the thing I've been trying to communicate to people, which at times has been challenging, I won't lie, because there's definitely some, you know, weird stuff that happens in crypto that grosses me out. But it's like, the difference is that in a decentralized ecosystem, the stuff that grosses you out doesn't preclude you from doing the good stuff, right? And so figuring out these kind of collective strategies, figuring out, and the inevitable conflict that's going to come from that too, right? When you get groups of people coming together saying, okay, you know, we're going to form a DAO that prioritizes this kind of art. And then there's going to be internal conflicts. There's going to be people leaving that DAO and forming other ones, which in my mind is great, right? In my mind, that's like, oh my God, you know, like we've restarted the beating heart of subculture in that case, right?
Because that's how it should work.
Exactly. We shouldn't be fighting over like, you know, playlists and Instagram posts. You know, we should be fighting over how we want our cultures to look. That's good. That's positive fighting, even though there's going to be some weird and weird tensions and outcomes that come from that. But hammering home that point has been quite difficult for people at this very early stage. And so I think it's sober to one be like, yeah, like this isn't going to, you know, it isn't going to happen overnight. And there's also going to be loads of turbulence. You know, there's going to be loads of like insane scenarios that one could not have anticipated. But restarting the beating heart of these different subcultures and giving people the ability to maybe form their own subcultures with these protocols is just so vital. It's like, it's like, thank God, you know, we're back somehow.
I think that's why we're starting to hear artists say that they think the internet is fun again.
Exactly.
That's certainly what I'm starting to feel as well. Healthy conflict is just exactly that. It's healthy. And I think we have not had a voice in so long with all of these ginormous platforms of Web 2. And now we're starting to see a space where our voices actually can emerge and we can have conflict with each other. And it's very human. And I think it is definitely creating a new kind of lifeblood for all of us. But yeah, I just, you know, I think about some of these spaces that are kind of reinforcing biases that were already present in the crypto community. And yeah. I think that that's something that really does urgently need to be addressed. So like while the blockchain is really neutral in some ways, it's also been shaped historically by those who have expertise and access. Mm-hmm. So I think right now, what's going to be really important is opening up those resources, providing some educational tools and outreach initiatives and events just to expand the scope of what's possible and ensure that there are more voices at the table.
Yeah, and I think you all have done a really good job on that, to be honest. I rarely go on Clubhouse, but every time I do, it feels like you're hosting a room, Lindsay.
I'll shout out Lindsay again on that front, because you know we did the tour to Clubhouse on all these NFT rooms, and it's just people freaking out about prices. And what we've just tried to do is like that clearly inevitably just happens on its own with human psychology. Yep. So how can we provide forums and contexts where the work, the people, the communities are actually engaging on the underlying work and the underlying motivations, and letting those other conversations take place elsewhere, because that seems to be what's needed most right now in the space. And that's what we're trying to do at Foundation as well. You know, rarely do you see us emphasizing the price of something. And I think even in the Snowden NFT case, the thing that I really wanted to get across to folks was just how symbolic and emblematic him entering the space was, because the exact reasons that he, you know, became a whistleblower are the exact reasons why this technology will not go away. It will not be put back in the bottle. You know, it really is a fundamental new superpower for humanity, and it's very substantive, and we're trying to drive people to that realization, you know, with the best of our abilities.
Yeah.
I also want to add that the way that we're thinking about curation at Foundation is really about bringing all of these different... Oh, what's that noise?
Oh, sorry, it's vaping. Me vaping in the corner. So, sorry, it's the soundtrack to being on this podcast.
It's so loud, though. It's like...
Oh, sorry, it's like Darth Vader in the corner. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. Sorry.
Oh my God!
Darth Vader has entered the room.
Yeah.
Yeah, I promise I have good intentions, guys, and I sound like Darth Vader.
Oh my God. One of the things that I love about Foundation community is that there is just such a great mix of types of creators. I know we get some flack for all of the memes, but I love the meme creators, and I love that the memes are here. I love that they're being compensated for creating these images that have made us all laugh or cringe or given us like these like emotional reprieves in these otherwise pretty sterile social media spaces for a decade. I love that the meme creators are here. I love that the photographers are here. I love that the graphic designers are here. I love that the 3D artists who are making really shiny objects that rotate are here. I love that the musicians are here. I love that the poets are here. I love that the writers are here. I mean, I love that this space can be open to anyone and that they can find the collectors who are really going to connect with their work and want to become long-term patrons of them. So I feel like there's this real vibrancy, and that's one of the things that I think makes Foundation distinct, is that we're really supportive of artists who are showing up in an authentic way and wanting to share their work and to also explore this new creative economy, as we like to call it, and craft it along, you know, all of us together simultaneously. So I'm very excited by the broad range of mediums. I'm very excited by the geographic diversity, the gender diversity, diversity in thinking and abilities across Foundation's network. There's a real richness here, and it's been like such an honor to be able to collaborate with and support all of these people.
I think the ability for creators to connect with collectors is really interesting when we look at Foundation in comparison to some of your more traditional experiences with auction houses, because it is so transparent. You can see all of the bidders. So there really is a potential for artists to be able to see not only the winning bidder, but also the whole community that is interested in their work and can potentially reach out to those people and form community around that. So I think that that's a really interesting, it's a subtle distinction, but you know, I mean, I don't know how it really works at like a traditional auction house, but I doubt that an artist would get a name print out of everyone who bid on their work.
Well, that's the thing. It's true. That's actually one of the, you know, in some cases, like on the kind of straw manning of the field where people are focused only maybe on the kind of the biggest sellers, etc. You know, there's another way to flip to contextualize that, which has been one of my arguments in the sense is just like you never saw this before. Like in some ways, you know, when you see perhaps from a subjective position, you see a large amount of money being transacted for something that perhaps you don't think is worth that amount of money. You know, this stuff is happening all the time in the art world and in other worlds. You just don't get to see it. Like, so in a weird way, like the criticism there in some cases, in my mind, is actually kind of an opportunity where you're like, we're now also entering into a scenario where for better and worse, there's going to be obviously turbulence around this issue. But for better and worse, you're able to actually trace where the money goes, like where the money's coming from. There's complications to that, obviously, because there.
And sometimes, you know, it's not like an actual name. It's just
sometimes
like
it's not actual name. Sometimes it might well be the artist themselves, which I won't talk too much about. But I think in some ways that kind of criticism is also an opportunity here. You know.
Oh, I think that's fascinating, and just to kind of give a few anecdotes around this. Every high profile auction that's taken place on Foundation, I have received messages about, you know, the other bidders or a journalist kind of exploring the whole, you know, cookie crumb trail around the auction. Yep. And where those people came from, and what were they doing, and how did they interact. And it's just such a, like a layer of color to the whole affair. And then to the point around the bids being, you know, all displayed, is there's so much emergent behavior, because the thing I'll remind you is that every bid that's placed on Foundation is real money. It's not someone. Yeah. It's not someone saying, I'd pay, you know, maybe I'd pay this. It's like they, by placing that bid, are essentially, you know, they are saying, I at this moment in time had this money that I locked into this contract to kind of signal intent. And you're seeing artists really embrace that. They're supporting each other. They're drawing attention to certain auctions through their participation, and they are using real money. And I think that is totally new, right? So, you know, every bid that's placed on Foundation is real. It's verifiable. You can click on the Etherscan link. You can see the funds that were sent to the contract, that were locked in the contract. And there's no way to withdraw that money unless you're outbid. So it is a real test. It's a real vote of confidence, you know, and that's a really powerful thing. It's much more than a like, I can tell you that.
Yeah. 100%. I couldn't agree more. It's definitely like, you know, I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine, Melissa Taylor, in my class a few years ago. And we were talking about, you know, I teach a class with, you know, 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds who've grown up in the kind of like economy. And she put it really well. She was basically like, no, we developed money to value things. It was such a simple point, but it was so on the nose where I'm like, you're totally right. She's like, when you put money towards something because you value it, that's like the invention of the technology, right? The technology was developed for you to say, I think this is worth this much. And so the ability to have skin in the game and actually commit yourself to it. And we've had that experience too, right? In this kind of like, I don't know if you could call maybe the kind of the passion economy of like your Substacks and your Patreons in some ways is kind of like a Web 2.5, like a bridge where you're like bridging from the like economy where it's like, you can get a million likes for something and not take that to the bank. And really like how sticky or how robust are those connections between you and that person? The difference between, for example, being on a Patreon, thank you to the patrons, and being like, okay, well, the number is certainly smaller, but you have valued the work that we are doing right here, right? Like you have valued the work by putting some money in there and saying, I want this to continue. The extension of that into this world where exactly as you say, even when you don't expect to win something, you're saying, this thing is worth at least this much. I'm going to bid on it. And that signal is also going to communicate to everybody around me that I mean what I say, right? There's truth in that gesture. Because correct. At the end of the day, you know what I'm saying? Like, and this gets abstract, and we could probably talk for an hour about this, but like the ability to also derive or divine truth from an interaction online has been significantly diluted in the like economy, right? Like how many things do you like online, you know, that you don't actually like, right? Like the ability to derive truth by saying, no, actually this person, I don't know what they feel about other things, but on this particular issue, I know that they feel the way that they do because they've put value on it. That way of divining truth to me is very, very significant and exciting. You know,
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's skin in the game. It's like, we now have these very, very, very powerful ways of expressing ourselves, you know, and I think it's really cool because money is now information is the way I think about it there, which is we've made it such that money can move just the way that information can move on the internet. And that just increases signal and expression and creativity just as it did in the early days of the web.
Couldn't agree more.
So Matt, I do want to pull back just a little bit to say that there has to be other ways of thinking about value just beyond currency and just beyond money, because we are looking at imperfect systems and imbalances where some people do have resources and some people don't. And it's going to get increasingly more difficult to acquire wealth in the crypto space the further that these currencies develop. And so what we're seeing right now in that artists are able to acquire this crypto through the sale of their work is what's really going to be a game changer. And what we're seeing on Foundation is that they're using it to pay their rent. They're using it in some cases to pay a mortgage or pay off student loans, but they're also redistributing these funds back to organizations that are fighting against racism. They're working on housing instability. You know, the Snowden auction benefited, you know, most famously the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Yep. And so I think it's a little bit dangerous to say that the only way of assessing value is whether or not it's tied to currency. I think we need to look a little bit more broadly then to ensure that there is more equitable access to these resources so that we don't just see the same kind of systems recreated indefinitely.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think it's a really useful signal, but it's not the only signal, you know.
Yeah, and I think access is important, and also kind of context, you know, the way that a work sits in a kind of historical timeline is sometimes more important, or most often more important than the kind of value that it's generated.
Yep.
So I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah. And you can imagine scenarios also where, as you mentioned earlier, with the kind of bidding, it gets a bit complicated with reserves. I guess the way that reserves work on Foundation, are you able to see bids in advance of the reserve price being met?
No. So the reserve price sets the floor
Okay. Cool.
And,
yeah.
And I also will say, you know, the product's ever evolving. I mean, anyone who's been an active user has watched us ship updates every week. I find that passive aggressive as a product designer, because it's like, if the artist set the price, the floor, they should be doing that with some intent on their end. It's not really like a haggling situation.
Yep.
And I think, we give them the option of changing that price. But, you know, for us, the intent is the artist has set the price, the lowest price that they're willing to sell the piece for. If someone hits that price, the thing goes up for auction for 24 hours, allowing anyone else to place a higher bid. And that seems like, and you know, given the success of the mechanic, I think it's something we've become kind of synonymous with, is like, it's just been very effective for artists to find the best price for their work. And also to give collectors, I think, clarity around what they're doing. Because again, these are all on-chain interactions. Everything on Foundation is on-chain. We don't do anything off-chain to kind of save gas, which we think is very weak technology. And so people are spending money to interact with the NFT. And on our end, it's like, you know, it's you want something to happen. You spent, you know, a gas fee to do something, you know, you're expecting a response.
Yep.
And these are the subtle things that, you know, we need to find the forum for ourselves to kind of express this to the community. But like, the fact that so many people right now are entering the space and don't have these clear mental models of what happens and how it works, right? Where just even gas fees alone are still confusing to people. It's very challenging as a product designer to know how to kind of frame these things to people. Because, you know, the number of times we're getting, you know, complaints around, why is this a gas fee? It's like, well, you're interacting with a blockchain. You're putting up money in a smart contract. That's how it works.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, this conversation has come up a lot, and it's probably a detour, but also in relation to like layer two or other interactions with NFTs on different chains, where if someone's just coming new to the space, the value of interacting on chain in a very decentralized network and the expense there also provides certain protections. But it's quite difficult to explain that, right? Like when someone's just coming to it, But that's great. I mean, that's great that,
I mean, have you considered having the bidding happen on layer two and then the actual, when the win happens, that then
moving to layer one?
Sorry, this is maybe really nerdy that nobody really knows.
That's just a whole can of worms, because the issue with layer two is, you know, and our team has a lot of experience. A lot of our experiments in 2020 were run on layer twos. This is something we speak from a lot of experience about, and if you think people are struggling to use the Ethereum mainnet with a wallet, adding a layer two requires you to switch networks. It requires you to bridge assets across those networks. There's different security guarantees on the different networks. And as a product designer, I mean, I just can't tell you how challenging it is to then bring a product into the world that you want as many people to use as possible. It's like, you know, we would be able to very easily do that. But the issue is how easy is it to use? And the ecosystem is just not formed there. And another thing that people don't really understand about layer two is that it's not really a matter of there just being a layer two. You need social consensus that is a layer two that you are willing to trust and to like bring assets into. And it's not just a matter of, does it work technically? Can you run the code? And that's another thing about crypto that people really underestimate, is it's not, engineers are limited also by the social constructs. And the reason why Ethereum is so vibrant is there are billions and billions of dollars already on it that allow for these new markets to form. And moving to an L2 you know, and we, you know, in our case, we were on XDAI for a lot of 2020. It's an unbelievable technology. And from a developer standpoint, we were able to do all sorts of things we could never do on Ethereum. But at the, there was probably $50 million in total available for the entire ecosystem. And that's not enough to support artists. That's not enough to support vibrant markets. And so it's not just a technical question. It's a social question. It's a coordination question. It's a time, you know, maturity question. And so I would just challenge people who kind of think that they can throw out like, oh, it's obvious you should use Matic for this or use XDAI for that. Like, you know, as a product designer, it's a little bit more nuanced than that.
Well, totally, because you're also, I mean, in a way, you're also leaning into accountability to people, right? Like if the conversation is that you're doing something immutable, that the source of value when you're selling these artworks is something that can be trusted and will retain value in future,
correct.
It's the responsible thing to do to move slowly. And yeah, I mean, that being said, of course, that doesn't invalidate the fact I've been playing around a lot with Polygon Matic the past few weeks. And it's like, wow, this is coming on. You know, I mean, like
it is,
and it's really encouraging, but in your guys' position, it makes total sense to me to err on the side of caution just so that you can guarantee the promises that you're making are guaranteed.
Real. Yeah, exactly. I mean, these are artworks where people are paying thousands of dollars for them with the expectation that they will live on indefinitely. And until there is consensus and social coordination to a new context that can offer those guarantees, it's irresponsible for a platform to offer that service, is the way I see it. And will we move and adopt that solution as soon as there is that consensus? Absolutely. And you have really no reason to, like, you know, if any user of Foundation should know that our team is just very technically capable, but we combine that with the wisdom of knowing that it's not just enough for us to throw engineering resources at a problem.
Totally. And actually in establishing accountability by committing to layer one, I would argue in many ways you could say that that actually makes the likelihood of layer two coming and being used more likely. You know, maybe this is like getting quite abstract now, but it's like, yeah, I've definitely seen a lot of in other ecosystems, for example, claims made around, you know, well, oh, you know, particularly around the energy debate, we're going to be having a podcast soon with an energy expert specifically on this issue. And it's like, it's not an either or. And in many ways, like, There's many things that seem like they would be logical, easy things to jump over to, and in actuality, there's all kind of complications there that people just aren't fully versed enough in the space to be able to weigh up the balances. You know, So I think that sounds sober and rational to me. But look, we've taken up a ton of your time. It is a Saturday. You all had a very, very busy and successful, I would say, a day yesterday. Is there anything else that you would like to share just before we ask our last question?
No, go ahead, Matt.
Well, so the question that we ask, and this was originally a suggestion by the JMO. Thank you, Jay, for this, because since he suggested it after the fourth episode, we've done it every time. Is what does interdependence mean to you? And if possible, I'd love to invite you both to share different answers.
I'll let Lindsay go first.
I was going to say I'll let Kayvon go first.
Interdependence is, I think, just a core tenet of something that we would probably put as a core value at Foundation, which is none of these markets, none of these technologies work without there being social consensus around them being valuable or them being a source of truth. And so we are interdependent. And I think that even the example of how we all believe that DAOs are going to be such a critical ingredient in the near future for this ecosystem is also, I think, emblematic of that, which is, you know, we all know, I think it's going to be even more interesting to be part of a collective that's buying an NFT than just an individual. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think interdependence is baked into these protocols and into these products and into these experiences now in a way that just wasn't true when you were interacting with more centralized versions of these technologies. And so it's really, I would argue, just a core tenet of of anyone that really is probably at, you know, aspiring to build anything of real value in this space.
I agree. That's great.
Interdependence is about inclusion and mm-hmm. mutual aid, care, and communal safety. I think interdependence is also about independence, and it's about operating outside of kind of hierarchical institutions and systems of oppression, and creating intentional spaces where we can support, uplift, and care for each other.
I think that's
wonderful.
Those are two great answers that overlap only minimally, but they cover a wide spectrum.
But they also reflect the organization that you both represent.
It's true. And yeah, I think, like, congratulations, y'all, because it's been, I mean, it's been wild. it's been a wild year for many different reasons. But like, yeah, you've really grown from strength to strength, and I'm excited to see where this all goes. We'd love to have you back, maybe at a later time when the opportunity arises to talk about something else.
After the DAO revolution.
Yeah, exactly. After the
Matt and Holly, I'm very excited about that, because I think that's right, which is this space is evolving, and Foundation itself will evolve with that space. Yep. And you know, we're aligned with y'all in that we really are here for the revolution, and we're actively, you know, trying to push it forward in the way that we can.
Wonderful. I trust that you are, actually, from all that you've built, I genuinely do trust that you are. I think it's been really impressive and wonderful to watch. So yeah, so look, like, thank
this was
you.
Fun. Thank you.
Super fun. Thank you for your time. Yeah, best of luck with everything coming up, and yeah, we'll speak again. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
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 Thanks, Holly. Really a pleasure.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Holly.